the situation was that I went with my husband, who is also a clinical psychologist, and we were also in a team that came to the people and told them when people from their family members were identified that they were murdered, we went to the family to tell. So there was one time when we went to two kids telling them that their parents died and were murdered. And we were with them in the room with an aunt and another family member. And all of a sudden I said, you know, Danny, who is my husband, and Danny's father and my father, they were in the Holocaust and they also lost their parents. And, you know, they became happy people and good fathers for us. And here we are with you now. And it was like, you know, it was like telling a lullaby. I knew that they hear us and they don't hear us, but I believed that the unconscious can hear me. And that's how the transgenerational thing, my personal transgenerational story helped me to help them to believe that a life can become after this disaster.
The music in your saying whatever you said was part of what worked there, both the liveliness and the something that has a real connection, trustworthy connection to experiences that one can survive from. Harvey, I think you get the point that this is a very unusual kind of intervention for psychoanalysts, and also that it may not fit everyone, that there is a match between how can one make use of oneself and go out of one's skin and one's routines and the way one I always do whatever I do and do something different that is echoing the need of the person with which you are in contact.
Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my two guests today are Mirav Roth and Mira Ehrlich-Ganur. They are both psychoanalysts and members of the Israeli Psychoanalytic Society. Our conversation today is around what happened to them, their country, and the victims of the October 7th massacre. We discuss the particulars of that day for them, how they engaged the people who survived, a guidelines procedure that Mirav created, born from her own past, and she will describe that in detail for us, the significance of President Biden's visit, and how the psychoanalytic community collectively have gotten together and are providing services for those who are so terribly afflicted. It is a powerful and important conversation, and I hope you find it useful and meaningful. Mirav and Mira, thank you for being here. I'm very appreciative. On October 7th of this year, we've encountered a new version of an old story. And the story throughout human history has to do with people who are devoted to the premeditated butchery of civilians. And here we are again. It's a long story, but we have many, many examples of it in our own lifetimes. We have, of course, Hamas on October 7th, premeditative butchery of civilians. More recently, we have ISIS-Daesh in the 2000s. In the 1990s, we have the Hutu murdering the Tutsis. And of course, in the 1940s, we have many examples. To pick one is the Einsatzgruppen. This was a group of soldiers. They weren't the regular soldiers. The regular soldiers invaded Russia going east. These were the soldiers, in quotes, who were behind them. And their charge was not to fight the Russians. It was to slaughter civilians. Again, the premeditated butchery of civilians. And they did in mass. They slaughtered Jews. They slaughtered homosexuals. They killed Catholic clergy, the Polish leaders, That was their task. And there's a true line from there to now. But there are differences. One difference, for example, is that the Germans, for the most part, sought to hide their crimes against humanity. And that's different from nowadays. Hamas celebrates the burning of babies and the rape of grandmothers. These are occasions for unabashed rejoicing. Famously, in the face of children being killed, candy is given to their children to let them know, this is the ego ideal we have for you. We want you to grow up to be a murderer like our heroes are murderers. We're familiar with that. That's not new news, as astonishing as it is, because in 9/11, when 3,000 people were killed when the towers came down, there was dancing in the streets. Again, candy was given out to children. So that's familiar, but there is something new now. In the States and in Europe, our neighbors are doing their own version of dancing in the streets. People march through our cities chanting death to the Jews. Jewish stores are being marked. No Jews allowed are signs that are now going up. Random Jews walking in the street are being assaulted in the States, in Europe. There are college professors who, when they first heard of the butchery of the innocents, said it was awesome, it was exhilarating, it was astounding. These are ostensibly civilized people, presumably educated people. It was energizing to hear about the mothers and grandmothers being murdered. So we here are living in this dystopian world. Day is night and night is day. But you, Mira and Mirav, you are living in Israel. And so all this is obviously much, much closer to you, but you also have the opportunity to be active. We sit and are helpless. We contribute where we can, but we're helpless. But you both are at the front lines, and that's the focus of our conversation today. What you've been able to bring to the survivors, to the refugees, all the people that have been tortured by their experiences. And we're going to get to what you've done and how you've helped and what we can learn from it. But let's start, Mira, with you by walking us through Saturday, October 7th, when you first heard the sirens. What was it like for you?
Thank you, Harvey. I appreciate this opportunity to have the story told, people listening to it and getting a glimpse of what we Israelis and Israeli psychoanalysts are going through. So thank you very much for this opportunity. October 7th, Saturday morning, holiday, we woke up with a sign of sirens. Now, it's not something unfamiliar to us. From time to time, every year, every 6 months, there is a missile attack in Tel Aviv, where I live, the center of Israel, a missile attack. There is a drill. We get up, we go to the shelter room, we lock the door. The shelter room is something that is by law compulsory to build in every new building, apartment, house in the last 20 years. And it is exactly to protect against all kinds of attacks. Shelter rooms were a very important player in the tragedy that went on in the invasion by the Hamas. Maybe you heard about it. Maybe we will talk about it. So personally, shattered in the middle of the sleep, what is going on? We go immediately to the shelter room. The drill is to sit there for 10 minutes. We go out, we open the television. What is going on? it took hours to start to realize that we woke up to a nightmare and that we woke up to a different world that we did not know before. And this realization got in slowly throughout the day. By the night of the day, and we were shattered, we were shocked. How can it happen? How can it happen to Israel? How can it happen to the, you know, biggest army in the Middle East, to this sophisticated army? How do we hear that people are locked and they are afraid of their life? Where is the army? Where are the savior? What is going on? I mean, this kind of question that shattered in a moment your belief in anything that is supposed to protect you, your government, your army, all the system put in place to protect you, all this collapsed in with the first siren.
And did you, in addition to wondering and worrying about your family, did you hear from patients early on? Did they contact you in this crisis immediately?
No.
Gotcha.
I think in a state of shock. I mean, everybody was, you know, like the body froze with the realization of the terror that is going on. And no, I think that everyone was okay. Very much into themselves and worrying about their family and their security. Now, not everybody in the country has a sheltered room like I have next to my bedroom. Many people don't have, and they have to take care of themselves during a missile attack.
I see. Merav, you want to start us off with your experience?
Yes, well, it's a bit similar. We both live in Tel Aviv, not in the same area, but we also have this sound of siren. I thought it's an ambulance. You don't really believe at 6:30 in the morning that there is a siren, but you do because you're Israeli. And what happened was that I remained awake and I started listening to the media. And it was devastating because it took the army about 7 hours at least until the forces could really give help. And the people were calling the reporters, the media reporters. So we were all traumatized only by listening to the people saying, whispering, there are terrorists in my house. They're shooting at my door. I'm the only one, the only parent here with my two kids. Please send the forces. Where are the forces? For hours. It was really, really terrible. We never had such an experience. I remember listening very carefully to the reporters themselves, who, Mira, you must remember, they sounded in panic because they felt that it's their responsibility now, but they could not offer help. So it was very, very radical and stressful. And that's it. And the rest of the day was spent just listening to this continuation and all that came after, and slowly realizing the massive, massive butchery that took place. Terrible day.
Now, you all, I assume, were in touch with your family members that were in the country.
Yes, of course.
And everyone I trust was safe, yeah?
My our daughter and grandson, after several sirens, they moved in with us because they don't have a shelter room in their apartment. So we were, you know, the close family, we were together, but in touch with everybody else. You know, when there is a siren and we go to the shelter, we text everyone, where are you? Are you okay? So the whole country is like connected to each other, checking if they are okay. And this reminds me of the mayor of New York speech.
Yes.
No, okay.
Yes. You know, one of the things I note in listening to you talk about the southern part of your country, to those of us who don't live in Israel, we tend to think of you, obviously, as a small country very close to each other. But for you, the south sounds like it's very far away. And am I correct that you yourselves don't feel in imminent danger right now, or do you? We're recording this just for the record on Saturday, October 28th. And do you feel that you yourselves right now are in imminent danger?
There was a house in Tel Aviv that was directly attacked today. So we are in a concrete danger. If there will be a siren, we will stop for 10 minutes. And we had a few today. So... unfortunately, we are in danger, but we are used to this kind of danger, and it's less intimidating than the danger that we encountered on October 7th with the intrusion of people into their houses, or the 2,000 youngsters in a party, in a musical party, that were slaughtered. So this is so direct, and that the civilians don't really... from other times.
I want to disagree with you, Mirav.
Okay.
First, there is the unknown possible attack from the north by Hezbollah. Their missiles are much more potent, and we don't have the answer. We have the answer to the Hamas missiles, which is called the Iron Dome, which is are intercepting the missiles, and most of the time successful. But as Mirav said, when they fall, it means that the interception did not work. The missiles, the possible potential front, new front from the north, is much more potent and is really very scaring. Very scary. This is one danger. The other danger that I heard in my family yesterday, who live also near you, Mirav, in Tel Aviv, is that the fear is that with helicopters or in some other way, commando, terrorist commando people will be parachuted or whatever into the heart of Tel Aviv. And so in this sense, we are not far from anywhere because you don't know where the potential danger may be. Now, this was the first time I heard of this scenario, but I understand that this scenario is well and alive and that... people in many neighborhoods are organizing like civil resistance, armed resistance. So again, I'm saying the obvious, the country is in utter shock and in utter fear. And, you know, we mobilized, everyone mobilizes oneself according to their personal mechanism of defense.
Right.
And happily, many mechanisms of defense are for active coping and doing and providing help to others. But the fear is there.
I think I agree with you absolutely, Mira. I think that the feeling is that all hell broke loose. All borders were, you know, crossed. All taboos were crossed. Mm. And that the security that we are used to depend on, like the army, was also not there. So it's a really uncanny state, but a concrete uncanny state. We were all thrown out of any sense of a stable ground and a safe zone that we can hide in. So I absolutely agree. And everybody are in a quite this or that amount of anxiety, and not only anxiety, but concrete fear too. And we don't know which part of it is because we are just terrified that it will happen to us too, and which is real. It's very hard to define now.
Yeah. Let's talk about the coping skills you mentioned about activity and taking care of others, because you have both been devoted, especially you, Merav, in reaching out to the survivors and the refugees. Tell us a little bit about your initial steps about going to the Dead Sea, and then I'll ask Mira to introduce some of the work that you've done.
Yeah. On Sunday, October 8th, I asked a psychoanalyst, Noa Corman, training. She's in training. She lives in the South, and I asked her, "Do you think the therapists in the South, in the area where all this happened, need a presentation, a lecture?" And she said yes. And I really, it's funnily enough or dissociatively enough, I don't remember when did I write it, but in the evening, the day after this terrible day, I gave a presentation with 10 guidelines to the hundreds of therapists in the South. And then at that day, my daughter, who is a young actress, went to the South, went to the Dead Sea, because she asked on Facebook, "Where do kids need me?" Because she's known by the kids here through television. So actually, I asked her, "Listen, where you go, ask them if they need someone to come and give some guidelines." And I followed her with my husband, who is also a clinical psychologist. And that's how I went to the Dead Sea at the beginning for 2 weeks. I spent the first 2 weeks with the refugees from Kibbutz Be'eri, who went to one of the hotels as refugees. They lost their houses. They lost their land. The land was destroyed, burned down. So they are all now in a hotel until they will find some kind of a settlement. It will take a year at least until they have their place back at their, so that they can go back. So that's how I went there. And I spent the first 2 weeks there. And we kind of organized a system that worked there with every need that we found that looks for an answer. How to, therapy, not therapy, it's not therapy, it's intervention, crisis intervention to babies, to youngsters, to the elderly, to the foreign caretakers of the elderly, working with the leadership of the kibbutz, working with the teams of the kibbutz that are arranging the funerals, that are in contact with the kidnapped families, etc., etc.
Can you tell us a little bit about where this came from in you, these guidelines? All of a sudden, it's as if they appeared, yeah?
Yes, I don't know exactly, but I think, first of all, I'm a second generation of the Holocaust. So I think since I was born, I was trained to think, what do you do when the day comes? And also I was raised in Israel, so the day comes every now and then. I'm a researcher of psychoanalysis and culture, and part of my research is about the Holocaust. So again, I was reading a lot of material about refugees, about being under such massive destruction and murderousness, and I guess it was there for me at my service. And also maybe when I was chairing the psychoanalytic therapy program in Tel Aviv University, we founded a clinic to the extreme populations, the extreme populations in need in Israel, like the homeless and refugees and et cetera, et cetera. So there also, I had to take care and to think, and I supervised, etc. So I think altogether I was at my service, but truly, I don't remember when did I write it. And it was just there, and it was intuitive. It was not. I cannot even say that I thought about it. It just came out as an immediate plan to take care of something that we needed to be taken care of right now.
We're going to get to what those 10 guidelines are in a moment. But Mira, you want to add something?
Sure. You know, I came to this hotel in the Dead Sea. I think 3 days later, and it's amazing what I found. It's amazing what I found. You know, having a lot of people with goodwill is excellent as a starting point, but it's not good enough. You need a thinker to organize all this goodwill. And this is what I found. This is what I found. I found an organization of helping system that is seeing 360 degrees around who is in need and providing the relevant help to the need. The organization was built, and I think the main architect of this organization was Mirav. She will not tell it about herself, so I want to say it. An amazing organization that is a cocktail of wisdom, deep understanding of psychoanalysis, and deep human empathy. Now, the cocktail is the important part because each one of the ingredients is necessary, but it's not enough. Empathy is not enough without you understanding what is going on and what is needed. Wisdom is not enough without your ability to step out of your usual therapeutic self and meet the people where they are in the deep shock and so on. And all this while organizing tens of psychologists, volunteers, who came and knocked on the door and said, we want to do something, we want to help. So really, this organization was amazing. And because of the very special combination, you know, the wisdom and the personality and the thoughtfulness of Mirav, she could really talk with many, many levels of the refugees and the refugees, the displaced people, the leadership of them, and provide a containing setting, organization, guide every new psychologist or mental health worker that came to join the force. And this organization in the making, after three days of a shock.
That's amazing.
Was really amazing. And before Mirav goes into explaining more about it, I want to say that, you know, since the 7th of October, and with a state of shock and with news coming in drop by drop, my mind was like in a fog. And the first time that I got clarity was when I went there and worked within this system in the Dead Sea. These were the most clear days. And maybe, Mirav, this was also your experience.
Mirav, tell us about this cocktail you've created.
Yes. Just before, I want to say that by no means it was me alone. There was There were others that we were working together, and that there are also other analytical assistants that maybe Miro will tell about later also. But
yeah.
I think if I want to explain it in general, I would say that it is like a proactive psychoanalytic manual, which I know sounds like a contradiction in terms, but I think that was necessary, and I think it still is. And I will try to explain. I felt, I can say it only in retrospect, that the attack was so radical, was so intense, and so overwhelming, that we need to have our psychoanalytic thinking and our psychoanalytic ideas, and to put them at the service both of each therapist that came and wanted to help, that a protocol, a regular trauma protocol, would not be enough. That you need to integrate the regular trauma protocols with psychoanalytic thinking, and to really make the, first of all, the therapists, but also the victims themselves, to let them know something about what was going on now in their psyche, without, of course, without using any psychoanalytic term, but trying to translate it. It's like a translating system in a way that will enable them to have this internal communication between the collapsing part and their life instinct, enabling them to regain their forces, to their destructed ego, to regain their ego functions, being overwhelmed by the death instinct or by survival's guilt, to be able to regain their life instinct, and to, I called it from survival's guilt to survival's obligation, like telling someone, listen, I know that you feel so terrible that you're here and your daughter or your grandmother is kidnapped and you don't know what's going on with her, but you know that when you worry so much about her, She knows that you worry for her, and it's so generous of you, because you also went through so much. It's so generous of you to think of her, and I'm sure she thinks of you at the same time. And that's a kind of communication that you can hold on to now. So this kind of talk, I internally think that I'm helping the good object to regain its presence inside, and the ability to see the other as a potent medicine, and to put some sense into a senseless situation, and to regain the alpha function when the mental structure is collapsing, etc., etc. And to move from the domination of evil and death drive into a domination of good. So it's, or another example, if I think, all the people there are already thinking again and again and again and again about this these hours with the people that they could help and the people that they could not help, and I and they go to the media and they listen to the media and they look at the films, the terrible films. So it's not only that I tell the therapist, but I also tell the therapist to tell the victims something that I internally think of is repetition compulsion coming from the outside. Like Freud told us, right, that flashbacks of the post-traumatic stress disorder is trying to regain control over an experience that lost all kind of control. So I'm not telling them repetition compulsion, of course, but I do tell the people themselves, listen, you want to go there because you lost so much control over there. It was so terrifying. And you feel as if you look at it again and again, or you think about it again and again, it will help you. But actually, it takes you back in time. And it takes you back to the place where you cannot control. While here and now, you have a lot that you can control. You can look around you. You can see who is in need. You can help your body to recover. You can write a letter to someone that you worry to, if it's children, etc., etc. So it's a kind of a translation system, right? That I don't need to say repetition compulsion in order to help the person to understand what his psyche is doing now and how to communicate internally in order to regain his forces, his power. I hope it's understandable.
And also help them regain their sense of goodness inside them.
Exactly. Yeah. And just one more sentence. We were doing that in two ways. One was when we were constructing the story with the people. We were trying not to enable them to lose borders even more emotionally, not to be flooded by telling the story, but intervening actively. That's also a part of being proactive, intervening actively and rapidly. They begin to tell you the story and you construct, it's not reconstructing, it's constructing the story because they were collapsing into total terror. So it's the first time that they're telling their story and you intervene. You say, what happened before? What happened after? And then you tell them, so that chapter ended this way and now we are here. And by that, you help them to go out of the collapse of a time sense that is like in a black hole, you know, the time sense goes mm-hmm. into the October 7th, into past, present, and future about the story that happened, and then again about where they are now. So this is another example.
Before I ask you about some of the other guidelines, Mira, you wanted to add something.
Yes, I wanted to convey what is the... You know, the list traumatized people. What did they go through? Somebody who survived and whose whole family survived. Still, they were locked for 17 hours in their sheltered room, holding the handle so that the terrorist... It does not lock automatically or mechanically, so that the terrorist will not open it very easily from outside, while all the time hearing shooting, cries in Arabic, while being connected to the system of WhatsApp of their kibbutz, and hearing that people get killed. So this is the least traumatized people. They only stayed and survived being 17 hours, not understanding how come help is not coming. And when help did come, they were already in such a paranoid state that they could not believe that this is help and not another terrorist play under emotions.
Because first of all, the shooting is in the house. It's not only from the outside, it's also at the door. The security door is blocking the shooting, but it's in the house. And also because the Hamas were telling them in Hebrew, open the door, it's Tzahal, it's the Israeli forces.
Yeah.
Time and again. So when the Israeli forces came, they were completely confused, not knowing and terrified, not knowing if to open. And it was between 17 hours and 30 hours, some of them, until they were evacuated from there to a safe place.
What more can you share with us about your guidelines, Mara?
Well, I think one more thing is to think about the general guideline is to think what was attacked and to try and, how shall I put it? It's like a complementary system, right? If from evil to good, from collapse of thinking to renaming and regaining the alpha function, from loss, from the collapse of a time sense into this black hole of one time zone, into regaining the past, present, and future, which includes also intergenerational trauma that came up a lot when speaking to the victims, a lot of them, the elderly, were talking about the Holocaust, about Israel's wars, Yom Kippur, that was exactly 50 years beforehand. And also, I think it was also, in a way, helpful, because what we saw that was that when they spoke about these past traumas, we could ask them, so how did you go about from there? And then they could remember and regain the sense that you can come out from the most terrible traumas into a future. There was one moment that was very, very strong for me. I will never forget it. I was in the kibbutz. The kibbutz, they met. First of all, it's a huge community. It's a community. It was a community of 1,200 people. Now it's about 1,000 people. Most of them were in this hotel. So, and in the evening, they had a kibbutz meeting of, I don't know, 100 out of the older people. First of all, it's amazing to see the power of a community. It's such a holding environment. It's so, so beautiful. And there was one day that they already had, you know, many bodies. I'm sorry to say this, but many bodies were hard to be identified because they put the houses on fire. And the burned bodies, it was not easy to identify, and they took DNA from the people in the hotel in order to identify their DNAs. And then when there was the first group of identified bodies, they stood on the stage, the leaders of the kibbutz, who are very impressive people, very impressive people. And they said names. They had 27 names, and they said one name, another, another, and in kibbutz, everybody knows everybody. And then after the 27 names, they said another 80 and something names of people who were, but we don't know what happened to them, if they are kidnapped or killed, because not identified. So it was like 100 and something names, one after the other, after the other, after the other, which was terrible. And then they read the names, and then the man said, and now I will read a poem. And he read a poem that was written after another event, disastrous event of Beit HaShita, that happened in another time. And it was for me such a strong example, first of all, the power of literature, the power of poetry to convey something, but also the idea that if we remember that there was a trauma that we went out of, that we survived, and I tell you this song now, this poem now, then you can all trust the idea that seems so far away now, that we will be able to survive this trauma as well. Was very, very strong. So I'm telling this because I wanted to say that intergenerational psychoanalytic thinking was also helpful. And I told the therapist, and we told the people themselves, again, it was proactive psychoeducation, psychoanalytic psychoeducation with the people themselves, telling them, so you're telling me that you find your strength in such a terrible time, and you built your family afterwards, and that's so important for you to remember now, and to lean on, to hold on to internally, because it seems probably very unreal now that it will happen again, but you do remember that you did it once, and we are now beginning a long way, and this is just the first days, but you need to remember. So this is the kind of interventions, from body collapse to regaining body recovery, et cetera. So from abnormality to normality, I can send you the 10 guidelines. I don't want to go too long, but this is the, and also it helped me. Just one more sentence. It helped me. The situation was that I went with my husband, who is also a clinical psychologist, and we were also in a team that came to the people and told them when people from their family members were identified that they were murdered, we went to the family to tell. So there was one time when we went to two kids telling them that their parents died and were murdered. And we were with them in the room with an aunt and another family member. And all of a sudden I said, you know, Danny, who is my husband, and Danny's father and my father, they were in the Holocaust, and they also lost their parents. And, you know, they became happy people and good fathers for us. And here we are with you now. And it was like, you know, it was like telling a lullaby. I knew that they hear us and they don't hear us, but I believed that the unconscious can hear me. And that's how the transgenerational thing, my personal transgenerational story helped me to help them to believe that a life can become after this disaster.
I think the music of your, the music in your saying whatever you said was part of the, what worked there. You know, both the liveliness and you know, something that has a real connection, trustworthy connection to experiences that one can survive from. And Harvey, I think you get the point that this is a very unusual kind of intervention for psychoanalysts. And also that it may not fit everyone, that there is a match between how can one make use of oneself and go out of one's skin and one's routines and the way I always do whatever I do and do something different that is, you know, in echoing the need of the person with which you are in contact.
You know, it's interesting you say that because I've always understood a psychoanalytic attitude to be one that does just what you've said, which is try to find where the person is, to meet them there, and from there, when able, to expand their awareness of where they are, which is quite different than working from a model of the way one is supposed to be. But let me ask you both. We haven't spoken directly about what this experience was like for each of you. We all know that turning passive to active is a wonderful defense, and it does very good things for many people. But where are the two of you with what has happened and what is happening in this moment? Mira, you want to start us off?
Well, yes, turning passive to active. As I said, this was the few days in which my mind was the clearest throughout all these 3 weeks. The other 3 days, which I had the same experience, was last weekend. I directed a group relations conference under the title Democracy Under Fire, Citizens Fighting for Their Values. And it was very challenging because it was an international conference on Zoom. And it was conceived when I was very much engaged with a protest against whatever happened in Israel, the attacks on democracy. And all of a sudden, this conference got a different echo chamber with a war, really. Yeah. Israel was under fire, and not only democracy was under fire. So I had to pull myself together to say, well, there are more than 50 people from all over the world who registered for a certain conference, and it's my role and also my honor, I think, to provide them with what they came to do the work about. So these 3 days in a conference under fire, part of it in the shelter room, was another moment of clarity of mind. Less television, less newspaper, focusing on what I am, potent at, and bringing my best together in this context. So these moments were very helpful. I must say that I have less patience for all kinds of regular things. I'm more involved in working and fighting anti-Semitism in whatever ways I can, and in being part of the health providing response system that maybe we will describe at some length.
Yes. We will in a moment, yes. Yeah. Merav, you want to share what your experience has been?
Well, people who know me sometimes tell me that whenever I'm asked, I'm speaking about the Holocaust, so forgive me if I'm raising it again. But I think for me it's a kind of another phase of trying to realize, for me, when I think what was the lesson that I was raised on by the Holocaust, it was two things. A, that we need to protect ourselves. And two, that the moral, the ethical lesson from the Holocaust is that we will always be empathetic and never silent about human injustice. And this crisis puts us in a very, very impossible situation, that these two values really clash. And I'm really worried about it. I know, first of all, there is a lot of a long mourning process, a complex mourning process to go through, of course. But I'm worried about the fact that that we are facing this clash of values and reality, and I'm worried about suffusing such radical murderousness and primitive systems I'm preoccupied with the question how to help my society, the general society. Of course, my patients, but the general society, to avoid being identified with these primitive, this primitive system of revenge and murderousness, and to keep our ethical values that that we are always trying to keep here, and it will not be easy. I'm afraid it will not be easy. Because we are terrified, and because we did suffuse a huge amount of murderousness and evil that is, and it will be so hard to help people not to demonize the other side. And I'm so scared of this vicious circle. I'm not scared of. I'm sure we will not. We will not use these kind of actions. That I'm not afraid of. I'm afraid of the psyche of the Israeli people.
Let me ask you about what it's like it being in the world. What about the world's reaction to this, which obviously has been varied, but what stands out, I'm speaking as an American, is President Biden's stance and how powerful it was. And I wonder, Mira, you want to start us off, what it was like for you Israelis to hear that?
Well, it was unbelievable. Really, I don't have enough words, to express the impact that Biden's visit had. Because we are, many of us, not all the country, but many of us feel that the leadership collapsed. We don't have a good father that we can rely on. Our Prime Minister Netanyahu did not meet with bereaved people, parents, did not meet with, until today, 3 weeks later, with parents of kidnapped children or brothers or parents, cannot say anything empathic. And here comes a man that gives a collective interpretation by his being, by his coming, by his meeting all these people that I mentioned, and hugging them in the most human way, shaking their hands, letting them put their head on his shoulder. And really, I mean, it was so moving. And not to say his speeches were so, the exact interpretation. I mean, if he did what Mirav is preaching, this is what he did. He talked to coming out of bereavement and having life after that, knowing the bereavement, knowing the loss. He spoke of the good in people, and he said, I will protect you. I mean, what more can you say? And this on the background of the lack of what we need from our leaders, which we don't find.
I agree, first of all, absolutely. And I think that maybe two more things to say about it was that what we encountered was a complete collapse of structure. Really, all hell broke loose. And a father figure that came put the hierarchy again into order. And there was again a father figure, and there was then the other could feel that he is the one in need, and that there is someone that takes care of him. So, and that was crucial. That was crucial because this is exactly the part that collapsed when we didn't have the army and the government to protect us. So I think the structure, it was restructuring internally, psychically, something that was very, very important. And also, he was, I agree with you, Mira, that it's similar to what we were trying to do with the victims. Instead of sensing, and many therapists felt, and that was the first thing to tell the therapists, the first thing they felt was, what can I say to a woman who was with her two children in the security room, protecting them? And then when they put their house on fire and she told her two kids, I need to sneak you out of the window because you are suffocating. And then when they went out, the kids were massacred. And the therapists asked, what can we say to these people? How can we say anything? We don't have one single word that we can think of as effective. And I think Biden understood what we were trying to help all therapists in Israel to understand, that it's exactly what you need there is an empathetic heart and face that tells you, no, 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 it is still relevant. The other is still relevant. Communication is still relevant. Structure is still relevant. And alongside the terrible bereavement, life is still relevant. All that was there when Biden came. It was very, very fruitful, and everybody reacted to it.
Before we close, I do want mention made of the activities of the collective psychoanalytic community to step up and fill the gaps. Mira, do you want to start us off describing that?
Right. Harvey, I have a question. I translated the numbers into American numbers. Shall I go ahead with
it? Absolutely. Please do. Yes.
Okay. So this may give a proportion to our listener. If they translate the numbers that are keeping being mentioned to the size of their countries. So I translated it to USA. We had 2,000 people killed in a single day. I'm talking only on the 7th of October. What happened on the 7th of October? 2,000 people killed, which will be like 60,000 American people killed in a single day. Then there were 229 abducted babies, children, adult people, older people, which will be the parallel to 6,870 American people. And then the most amazing number is the circle of directly affected, which in Israel is 20,000 to 30,000 people. In America proportion, it will be 600,000 to 900,000 immediate affected people. So the three psychoanalytic societies came together within an organization that is called First Line Med, medication, and created a system to respond to various kind of people in need, bereaved people, people who have family kidnapped, and people who were just traumatized. I want to read just, there are hundreds, you know, if there are 20 to 30,000 people in need of some kind of contact. So you can imagine that there are hundreds every day. And in order to give you the feel of how wide it is spread and how the system works, I will just read, I copied half a day. So help is needed to a soldier that is serving in the Gaza unit, and many of her friends were killed or hurt. We are looking for therapy to help a 7 years old girl that her cousins were killed, and it creates a lot of stress in her. I'm looking, and each one is in a different part of the country.
Yeah.
I'm looking for a therapy for a man that two of his brothers lived in the south area, and the family was hardly it. And there is a need for a single soldier, meaning that her family is not in the country, that was engaged with with an encounter with a terrorist. And she is in a deep stress and is looking for a therapist, English-speaking therapist. So I think it gives you the idea of the spread of the needs and the spread of the misery. Now, each of these calls get an answer within 3 minutes.
That's remarkable.
So you see the call. And you see, after 3 minutes, the call got a response. The call got a response. There is no one single call that did not get a response.
It's even more than that. We do, like, I don't know how you say that, Harvey. I show you.
Thumbs up. Yeah, thumbs up.
Yeah, thumbs up. So each request gets like a few thumbs up, and one is taken. So it's really fascinating. It's beautiful. In general, I must say that the general solidarity in Israel now is also overwhelming. The devastation is overwhelming, but also the solidarity and helpfulness is overwhelming. Yeah.
You know, I have to share that it's very difficult for me to listen to your stories. You both individually, and I imagine collectively, have a resilience. You've each made mention to, well, we're sort of used to rockets coming, or there's a safe room next to my bedroom. These are things that you live with taking for granted. And you know, of course, people outside of Israel don't live with that and don't take it for granted. So to hear the stories is so earth-shaking for those of us who feel vulnerable in a different way. Obviously, you're literally vulnerable, but emotionally, you have figured it out somehow. And I don't say that glibly, and I don't say that disrespecting of what work needs to be done. But you live what you tell these patients. You have lived and survived a past trauma, and you can do it again. And that seems to be the theme that you meet this calamity of butchery with, that you have lived through past traumas, not only in your lives, but prior generations' lives, and we will together live again. And I can't tell you how grateful I am for your sharing your story, the amazing work you do, the clarity of your vision, your heart and your mind working together so magnificently for all the people you make contact with. Thank you so much.
Harvey, if I may, I just want to add one thing that we are, only if it's okay with you.
Please.
We are collecting donations for our for this analytic group. We want to provide years-long-lasting therapy to the many, many, many thousands of families and people that will need help. The state will be able to give a few sessions. So the Life Med is collecting donations, and whomever wants to help us, I will send you the link. And if it's okay with you, you can share it, because I know we got many, many letters from psychoanalysts around the world that we wish to thank deeply for the empathetic and genuine support and empathy that we got from all over the world. And many ask us how to help. So this will be very helpful, not for us, but for the people we want to help.
Please share the link, and I will include it in the show notes for all to see.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you both. Perhaps further down the road, we will have another version of this conversation. Be well and be safe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Harvey. And thank you, Mira.
Thank you, my love.